Hello, everybody. thanks for sticking around till the end. That's really awesome. I know it's hard to take a whole chunk of your day out, so thanks. As Kent mentioned, my name is Brielle Bowden. I'm a university student here. I'm in my second year of the Indigenous Governance Graduate Program. And so this project actually kind of came about as a opportunity because my advisor, Dr. Shaila Shukla, had received a small grant from the Shastri Indo-Canadian Institute. This is what I'm here to share with you today on behalf of my research team. And Carol's sitting in the back, and she is from Fisher River Cree Nation, and she played such a huge role in creating this project and also facilitating it, so making sure that there were participants and getting all the timings, and it was just great. So I'm glad that Carol's here to see the presentation, and so feel free if you have any questions to also ask Carol. Before I start talking, I just want to discuss two terms that I'll use, just to give you some background. I'll be using food security for the larger part of the beginning of the presentation, and food sovereignty towards the end of the presentation. Food security is defined as all people at all times having physical and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. So that was a quote from the FAO in 2008. And food sovereignty is a new and emerging theory. It's come in the wake of food security. And essentially, food sovereignty follows food security in that it invites a cultural component and often a spiritual component of this right of people to food and to food systems. And so, I'll get into that a little bit later, but that's just so you have a little bit of background. So as mentioned, the community that we partnered with, after receiving the grant, which was, the grant was meant to talk about social learning and food security. And the proposal was that we would have a community here in Manitoba and as well as a community in India. And so today I'll only be speaking about the community that we worked with in Manitoba, which was Fisher River. And it came from contacts that we had, the university had, some already established contacts. And so we partnered with the Fisher River Health Center, which is where Carol works. And so they played a leading role in the project. And it worked really well. After communicating with them and after several visits, we realized that we had mutual interest in the research, that a lot of our interests related to social learning, food security, food sovereignty, were part of what the health center was interested in documenting food histories, local food histories, and aspects that related to health and community health programming. So the goal of this community-based action research was to promote and revalorize Indigenous knowledges associated with cultivation, production, and consumption of traditional foods and community food security. So oral history, as we discussed throughout our communication, fit both the researcher's agenda through the funding mandate and also the community's agenda, as I just discussed with you about the preservation of the local histories, as well as looking or getting a more in-depth look at the food-related issues in the community. So to give a background on the existing literature on the topic, as many of us know that oral history is used as a unique method to document and highlight life experiences, including activities such as, in our case, the traditional family life, culture and spiritual life, land claims, disasters, Indigenous knowledges related to food harvesting practices, etc., and the list goes on. As we saw today, there's so many unique ways that you can use oral history. Indigenous knowledges and perspectives related to food and wild plants and associated practices have been documented in research to gain insight into Indigenous epistemologies, knowledges, and learning systems. However, these studies do limit the collection of Indigenous perspectives through their use of structured interviews specific to research questions and do not invite or privilege indigenous histories and perspectives on the issues at hand. And so that was a large reason for choosing oral history. So as previously mentioned, the goal of the community research was to promote and revalorize indigenous knowledges of cultivation, production, consumption of traditional foods. So cultivation could include hunting, fishing, berry picking, etc. Production could include methods of preparation from the recipe stage to deboning, boiling, pounding, whatever. And consumption would include who the food was shared with, how it was shared, and how it was decided that things were shared, and so on. So therefore, the purpose of the research was to explore local histories from the perspective of harvesters, such as those who are or used to be hunters, gatherers, gardeners, fishermen, and women. And those are the people that Carol picked out and identified in the community that would be part of the interview process. And so we had chosen, I think, 21, and we had conducted 17 interviews at the end over 3 days with three researchers from the University of Winnipeg. So our four objectives was to document the local histories, to explore the perspectives on food security and food sovereignty in the community, and to understand local challenges related to food, and to generate recommendations, to enhance community food security and sovereignty. Some of the initial findings after the transcription process and after talking amongst ourselves was that there was, you know, after the elders had shared their knowledges with us, we just recognized, wow, these people are living libraries. They hold so much knowledge, and it is invaluable. And so it was just so amazing to be part of, hey, wait a second. There we go. It was just so amazing to be part of that journey, to document that and offer that to the community. Hi, Jasmine. Jasmine's one of the other researchers. So, hello. So the elders knew so much, and they told so many stories of being young and what it was like in the community, and how food played such an integral part, not only the eating, the consumption of food, but the production and the cultivation of food. It just played so many roles. I can't even begin to explain or list them, and it wouldn't even do its due diligence. So it was not only important because they held so much knowledge, but also because they are elders and they are passing, and it is important that, you know, that this is that is just another reason for the importance of preserving those knowledges. So some of those the themes that came from the stories and from the local histories were the value of land-based foods. I know that Matt kind of talked about it even in his presentation about, you know, that being a staple role in identity. And this was totally, food is huge, and land-based food was the most important. Most stories related to hunting, berry picking, and included the whole family. And so, and it wasn't even about only nutrition, and it was about the entirety of health and well-being, mind, body, and spirit. And many share the view that traditional foods and practices did maintain the good health throughout their life, and that was a reason that they were still here today in full strength. Another common theme was that food is medicine and medicine is food, and that there was actually no difference between the two, that they weren't acting in different silos, but rather they were an integrated, they were totally in relationship with each other. And so that was really interesting to see. Like, when people were talking often about health, they talked about eating the good medicine, and that was what you were reaping from those foods that were so precious and nutritious and good for you in maintaining your health. And so that was really interesting. And it was interesting after, even throughout our conversations at post-research process, about, you know, kind of talking a little bit more about what is the role and the difference between food and medicine. Like, is medicine just a medicine because, you know, in the Western world we say, oh, You know, that's a plant and you pick it and it's medicine. But, you know, why is it not that when we harvest an animal that that is not medicine also, you know? So it's very interesting. There was also a growing concern for the environment's implications on land-based food quality. So that was a large overarching theme just about, for example, the quality of the water and some of the quality fish that were coming, like the quality of the fish that were coming out of the water. And that played a large, that really you could tell that impacted the interviewees. It impacted their views on not only the process of you know, the benefits of going out there to do those things continually, like if they, like, you know, it was, how do I say this better? Like, it didn't only impact, like, the reason for maybe why they have no less interest, perhaps, in doing some of those practices, but it also, they thought about it when they were eating it. So there was fish or geese, you know, thinking about the migration patterns of the birds, where they're eating from along the way, like not only in Canada. And so that was something that was seriously considered, and that came through as a very strong theme. There was also a concern for younger generations. Largely, they were associated with the knowledges of the foods and the practices. And secondly, that the, you know, the decrease in use and practice and consumption of the land-based foods, that maybe those knowledges, there was a scare that there would be, you know, less of the younger generation to be able to carry that forward onto further generations. So almost that there was a knowledge gap. There was a concern about knowledge transmission as another theme. And lastly, this kind of goes with the all five of the overarching themes that I'm talking about. But we kind of documented the foods eaten in the past as the elders talked about them that were very common. So we made note of all of them, and we made this chart. So we based it on fish, wild game, vegetables or garden harvest, livestock, and bush harvest, including medicines. And then we did a comparison with foods eaten today. So take a look at this list. And then these were the common ones that were now eaten today. There might be a few missing. Carol, maybe you see some missing, or I don't know. But this is kind of what we felt was... So this is a pretty big shocker if you compare those two lists. And sorry, the columns don't actually have to do with any. They're not divided. They're only on horizontal. But yeah, so that was really huge. So on this note, I'm just going to play a clip of an interview that was done with Jerry Mason, who plays a strong role in the community as a as an educator. But he does a very unique class, which is... an outdoor education class where he teaches traditional practices and harvesting methods, and so he does that with the whole class. So actually, while we were there for the oral history interviews, it was amazing because one of our researchers had been invited to go on a goose hunt in the morning before. So he went the morning, he got a goose, actually he got two geese, and then they harvested it with the class together. And that was an opportunity that they had a focus group, which I'll probably talk a little bit more briefly about later. But, like, that was amazing, you know? And so that was such an amazing experience, and it just, so he is very much informed about these food-related issues in the community. And so this is Jerry Mason.
In our community, like with my students, we were just talking about, we're doing a goose hunting part of the program right now. So we're preparing the kids to go out and do some goose hunting.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a very traditional activity for our people. And I was telling the kids that, I'd say even 10 years ago, out at the lakeshore, you would have anywhere from 15 to 20 hunters, you know, going out and doing that activity. And I'd say in the past, you know, I'll take for instance last year, there was maybe a handful of hunters out there. And so I was telling my students that, you know, that's evidence of our, you know, our tradition of just that part, the goose hunting is you know, declining. So you talk about food security, like, you know, when I was growing up and going out to my grandfather, and like we would take the geese and we'd do different things with it. Like my grandfather would cook it and preserve that goose in different ways. And you know, and the big thing about you're talking about food security, like we would put a lot of this away. You know, for the, you know, sometimes it was in the fall after hunting. So it's put away for the winter, springtime hunting. We do springtime goose hunt right now. So it's put away for the summer and, you know, and kept. So the goose hunting has been a big part of the community's activity. And like I said, I was telling the students just today that that's declining. I said, I asked them, like, how many of your family actually are into goose hunting? And that, and two out of 16 today said that in that particular class, their parents are involved with one way or the other with hunting. But, you know, two out of 16, that's... And that's another sad thing, because, you know, our traditional activities, that's just one, the goose hunting. Mm-hmm. It's on the decline. So, you know, saying that our community right now is losing that part of our, you know, our tradition.
So did everybody pick up on kind of the message of that? Was that there was the students that he has in his class, he asked them, how many of your parents or people in your household are, you know, would do a goose hunt? And two of 16, rather than in the past, he probably would have said almost close to, you know, 100%. So it just kind of goes to show that the practice is becoming, is declining. And so this is exactly what his program that he's doing at school is trying to promote. So it's really amazing. I also have another clip from another interviewee whose name is Dorothy. And she was actually our first interviewee, and she just gave us just the best. She just rolled with her stories like she had been saying them for years, like she was ready for us to come for years. And she's like, I had asked her, you know, where did you learn what you know about food? And this was her reply. So where did you learn what you know about food? Who taught you?
Well, our parents, we grew up, you know, as soon as we were able. You know, we grew up, even when we were small babies, you know, our mothers, grandmothers, we were always together. Everything that they did, you know, we were there all the time since we were small. You know, they put us in that cradle board, and the mother takes and puts us right there, and we watch them, and they're cleaning fish and cleaning ducks, cleaning everything. You know, I could, you know, see all these things.
And the women and the men were both helping out in this? There's no one person doing this, one person doing that? Everyone's doing everything.
All the young girls, young boys, you know. Even thing, the small games were taught for the young men, you know. And then from there to the larger games, you know.
That's right, yeah. You know? Kind of teaches you for the rest of life. And what about you yourself? Did you go hunting or fishing?
Well,
or trapping?
I did trapping, yeah. Like right now, I used to do muskrat trapping, of course. And we killed small animals like weasels and squirrels, you know. And we clean them and skin them. You know, we were taught all those things. You know, and we were taught, and we knew, I pretty well know which animals we don't need, eh? You know, animals that are not
edible. And who told you that? And well, what are a few of those animals? I'm not really sure.
My grandmother, my grandfather, my our parents, you know.
Yeah.
And our uncles and aunties. You know. Everybody, like I said, everybody was together long ago.
Mm-hmm.
We were never, not a whole bunch of people. Like, everybody had their own designated trap line, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe there's five or six group of families in that one area of trap line. We didn't live all together, you know.
Yeah, that's also a really interesting thing. I'm not sure if you picked up on that, but she said we knew which animals were edible and which animals were not edible. And that's something so interesting that I would actually love to learn more about. But regardless, the clip that I chose was to kind of highlight the fact that learning in the stages of consumption, production, cultivation, is generational, and how important that generational learning is. And for different reasons that were mentioned in several of the interviews, including residential schools or just how the impacts of parenting might have affected these practices. But once there's a gap in a generation, it really does impact the generational abilities of the generations following to be able to keep on with these practices. And it has such a large impact on a culture, on health, on identity even. So I just want to conclude by talking about oral history as a component of inspiring further action. As I mentioned, there was that opportunity for the researcher who had got the geese. So he was able to do a focus group with the youth of the outdoor education class, which was an amazing opportunity, but also just an amazing personal opportunity for him and for us even to kind of walk into the room after and go see and to see, like, to be in a classroom where these kids are, you know, plucking the goose and gutting it and whatnot and learning about that process. Also, as I was discussing, we talked a lot about food security at the beginning. That was kind of the original theory or framework used in the proposal. And then our conversation started to change and morph into, you know, maybe let's start talking about food sovereignty a little bit more. Because there's a lot more than just having access and affordable, nutritious food. There's more to food than just those pillars. And including, as we saw, a large cultural component, and often for many, a spiritual component. And then lastly, there was already interest from the health center. Carol was interested in making a community cookbook. And so there was a student here at the University of Winnipeg in the MDP program who needed practical experience. And so she, you know, decided to help out with this idea. And they actually made a community cookbook. And they actually did all the subtitles in Cree. And so it had a lot of traditional recipes as well as new recent recipes. Am I right, Carol? So that will be coming out soon. So it's just really cool that something like oral history, you know, we just never know how far it can go. And it's just amazing that it actually stemmed, like, action in different ways. And it's all about just those histories that were given for, you know, an hour, two, or three even. So, yeah, that was really cool. So I just wanted to share that. And I thank you all for listening and for spending the day here. And that's it. And we also really, really like to thank Fisher River for, and especially Carol, you put in so much work in the interview process and setting up everything. So thank you so much. Okay, great. Thanks.